You're listening to Domestic Diplomat. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Understanding Europe. And today, Brendan and I are trying to understand the concept of strategic autonomy, also referred to as strategic sovereignty or other names. You might have seen the term circulating online in light of recent events, such as Macron's visit to China, for example. But what does strategic autonomy mean as a concept, but also as a strategy that the EU is pursuing? To answer these questions, we talk today with Professor Dr. Sophie van Hoeneker, an expert on European external relations and chair in administrative governance, and Jean Monnet Professor at the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences, aka FASOS. We're very excited to unpack this concept and look at it from the EU's perspective and what is its strategy and what does it actually mean to be strategically autonomous. So let's get the conversation started. Welcome, Professor Sophie.
Thank you again for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we dive into the idea of strategic autonomy, we thought it would be best to unpack a bit of what the concept means. But in order to actually do that, we first have to understand the context of, you know, where we are and where we've come from. Understanding the shifting international environment and the changing global order, placing the EU in it as an actor and participant, shall we say. Could we start off with giving a bit of an overview of some of the major dynamics that are reshaping the global order today?
Yes, definitely. I think indeed it's a good idea to briefly shape the broader context. And I think it's no exaggeration to say that the world is really at a crossroads at the moment. And this has everything to do with the fact that we are living a geopolitical moment of changing power distribution. And we are moving or trying to establish a new world order. The post-Cold War order, where the US was the sole hegemon after the defeat of the Soviet Union, is under pressure. That's very clear. And this order is being contested by new powers such as China. But besides the rise of China, I would say there are also other important developments. And we have seen Brexit, but also the arrival of power of Donald Trump some years ago, the COVID-19 pandemic, and more recently, the Russian aggression, the Russian attack of Ukraine. And all of this have further strengthened these geopolitical pressures. So you could really say that we are in formative years where key powers are positioning themselves. And the outcome of this power struggle will really be very important, as it will determine the power structures of the coming decades. So there is a lot at stake, I would say. And what is of interest for us as Europeans is, well, what type of position will the European Union occupy in this emerging new world order? And it's clear that if we still want to have some weight, we will have to act together. And because the individual member states like France and Germany, even the big ones, they don't have the international weight anymore to make the difference. And so the question of relevance for us is then, well, will we be merely part of the American bloc, or will we also try to occupy a more independent role? And this is where the whole debate on strategic autonomy is coming in. And it's one of the main ideas, strategic autonomy, it's one of the main ideas that has been put forward to deal with the increasingly unstable international environment.
Overall, the big shift from almost the post-Cold War environment, where we had complete US and Western hegemony, moving towards what often likes to be framed as a multipolar world, so,
yes.
So where multiple regional powers could have more of an influence both on their immediate environment but also the global order. So mainly within all of this shifting of the let's say power distribution, mm-hmm. From being one held mainly in the grasp of the US, right now it is how different actors, for example, India or China or the European states in the form of the EU, are positioning themselves now relative to what they see coming as the change of the global order. Is that how?
Yeah, exactly. So we see a kind of shift in the distribution of power resources. And so that's why, of course, everybody is trying to position themselves and try to get the best position for themselves for the coming decades. Mm-hmm. And of course, the US, we see that the US is quite aggressive towards China. And that also has to do with the fact that the US sees China as the main competitor. And it wants to make sure that, America continues to occupy a major role and can set as much as possible the rules of the game.
So how does the EU then fit in as a functional actor as it is able to position itself? Because it is not necessarily a nation, so it's a bit of an odd participant. I mean, right now, a lot of EU states are NATO states, and if not in other ways, dependent on American security provision. So how would you then place the EU within this shifting dynamic?
Yeah, so the EU is, of course, looking at this ongoing game and is, of course, also thinking about its future position in the world order. And the European Union realizes that while on the one hand, certainly in terms of security, it still depends a lot on the US, it is important also to, make sure that it is not just simply overrun by the other big powers. So, and the answer of the European Union is, strategic autonomy. So the European Union is thinking, how can we position ourselves? As such, of course, the idea of strategic autonomy is not a new idea. And so already back in the 1960s, the French president de Gaulle was already pleading for our own European security identity independent from the US. However, most of the Western European countries who profited from the American nuclear security guarantee were not very much interested in this idea because they thought it was an illusion and they really wanted to put all their security eggs in the NATO basket. After the Cold War, of course, things started to change because we were uncertain whether the Americans would still continue to commit themselves to European security. And there were a lot of debates about the death of NATO. And so in the late 1990s, in Saint-Malo, the French President Chirac at the time and the British Prime Minister Blair got together and they said, it's time also for Europe, for the European Union, to have the capacity to act autonomously. What did that mean? Well, actually, it meant different things for the French. For the French, it was more the capacity to decide independently. For the British, it was more about autonomous capabilities. Anyway, the debate was launched. And as a result of this, we saw the development of a common security and defense policy. However, the term strategic autonomy was not used that much at the time. So we have seen it for the first time being used in European Council conclusions of December 2013. When the heads of state and government were calling for the development of a European defense technological and industrial base. And so the idea was we should develop our own capabilities also to become more independent of the Americans.
Capabilities as in security capabilities, you mean?
Yes, indeed. Okay. It was primarily about security capabilities. But what we have seen as time went by, that this term of strategic autonomy that was initially launched in the realm of security has also been extended to other areas such as trade, digital technology, health, energy, and so on. And here I would like to point to an interesting speech of Macron at the Sorbonne back in September 2017, when he did not only plead for autonomous military capabilities, but also identified European sovereignty in areas such as border protection, energy, digital technology, and the economy as the best response of the European Union to strategic challenges.
So a much more kind of holistic approach where you very much include not only just the hard military power, but the industrial base to provide that, the capabilities of acting with it, so logistical capabilities. For example, we saw that in Afghanistan recently, the Europeans were much more dependent on the American lift capability to get out of there than having their own ability to do that. And then you say on top of that, there's another level of economics and, mainly economics, shall we say, trade, etc.
Indeed, yes.
Okay. Just to go back to one thing you said as the almost the beginning of the strategic autonomy debate in Europe, you pointed at Saint-Malo, which was a meeting between Blair and Chirac to talk about the starting of developing of these collective capabilities. I wonder how you then would see Iraq not too long later, so 2003, where that was one of the big fault lines in the NATO alliance, right? With Germany and France not wanting to participate, but the British wanting to participate, pushing it with the Americans at the UN level. How would you then maybe see this as a test case for the early stages of strategic autonomy in that sense?
Well, indeed, the British and the French were in totally different camps, but that did not really come as a surprise, I would say, because the British have traditionally always been very much Atlanticist. And the fact that in Saint-Malo, the British supported this idea of autonomous capabilities did not mean that they would abandon NATO. For the British, it was always clear that NATO continued to remain the most important European security organization. Whereas for the French, of course, they also realized that this was still the case, but the French had much more ambitions in terms of autonomy. So for the British, it was more in terms of capabilities. For the French, it was really about taking autonomous decisions independently of the Americans. So in that sense, also after Saint-Malo, there continued to be this Europeanist camps, let's say, versus the more Atlanticists.
That helps clear it up a bit. Should we maybe dig a bit deeper into the term of strategic autonomy then, now that we have a bit of an overview of the context that we find ourselves in and have found ourselves in the last few decades?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a good idea, although giving a definition is not so straightforward because it's a very ambiguous term, strategic autonomy, and also different people understand different things under strategic autonomy. And that's probably also why it's a term that is working in the European Union, because everybody can imagine something else under this term. Nevertheless, I can make an attempt, and you could say that in general terms, you could say that strategic autonomy is the capacity of the European Union to act independently in realizing its strategic objectives and defending its interests and values. So this can be strategic objectives in the area of security, but it could also be in the area of trade, energy, digital technology, and so on. So that would be in a nutshell kind of my definition.
What is the difference then between the security aspect and the economic aspect of the external relations when you're talking about strategic autonomy?
Yeah, no, I think it's very good indeed to make this distinction between the strategic autonomy in the area of security and external economic relations, because to some extent, these are also different debates and there are also different sensitivities. And it's also interesting to see that although the debate has started in the security domain, we actually have been making more recently more progress in the field of external economic relations. So, but when we talk about the security domain, well, we very often make a distinction between, on the one hand, political, operational and industrial strategic autonomy. And so when we talk about political autonomy in the field of security, it's about the capacity of the European Union to set its own foreign and security goals. Also, we talk about strategic documents like the Strategic Compass or the European Global Strategy. When we talk about operational autonomy, it's more about the structures and the capabilities that we are needing to conduct military operations. And there is also an important industrial dimension. We should not forget this, because actually the European industry in the field of defense is very fragmented. So this industrial dimension refers more to the independent ability to procure defense capabilities. So do we have the industries that are capable to produce the weapons or the instruments that we need to guarantee this autonomy?
Okay, you could break it down to three parts, where the first one is actually making the decision. So on paper, putting white papers forward, we would like to pursue these goals that might be different to the ones of the US, which I guess is the main partner in this regard. Secondly, the ability to pursue them. So the capabilities themselves. So can we move guns around? Can we go help someone in a crisis situation, et cetera, et cetera? And then the last one is making sure that is available in the long run through domestic, I guess,
production capabilities. Yes.
Okay.
Indeed. Yeah. So you see, this is quite different actually from the field of economics, where you have totally different questions. In the field of external economic relations, there the idea of strategic autonomy refers to areas such as trade, but as I said already before, energy and other issues. And well, I will say a few more words about the area of trade, because there it has actually developed most. And there we have seen a very important development back in 2021, actually, when the European Commission has adopted a new trade policy review. So the European Commission was realizing we need to reorganize our trade policy, taking into account this rapidly changing world. And so the Commission used the term open strategic autonomy. And that's very interesting. They added this term open. So they talk about autonomy, but at the same time, actually, they want to show or emphasize that the European Union still would like to remain committed to multilateralism and free trade, because we have profited a lot from these. But at the same time, the European Commission also realized that, we should not be naive, and the world is becoming increasingly aggressive. And so that's why they have started to develop also, beyond remaining committed to open trade, also develop some whole range actually of trade defense instruments, which are there to help the European Union to, for example, protect critical infrastructures, or to also protect supply chains, and also protect itself against economic coercion by players like China, for example.
I just had one question to between the two is, how would they then meet in the economic and the security aspects, especially when you take, for example, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the way then that also has a ricochet on Chinese-European relationship within the latter half, the economic half of this discussion?
Yeah, very good point, actually. So it's interesting to see, to some extent, the debates are running in parallel, because we see also that there are different players being in the lead in the field of security. It's much more the member states, and especially key players like Macron. Whereas in the field of trade, there the European Commission plays a very important role, because trade is an area where the European level is autonomous. So member states have delegated their sovereignty to the Commission. Of course, the member states still play a role in the decision making together with the parliament, but still the Commission there has the exclusive right of initiative. So on the one hand, you see parallel debates, but of course they are linked, because what we see is that now trade becomes much more instrumental. And so trade becomes an instrument to realize the strategic objectives of the European Union as such. And so when we talk about strategic autonomy and we talk about the idea of the European Union being autonomous in strategic terms by defining its own objectives and trying to realize this, trade then becomes an important instrument to realize these strategic goals. Mm. So in that sense, there is definitely a clear link. And so it's also, you could say, also a kind of change in terms of in the sense that traditionally trade policy was very much self-standing, because it was very much about multilateralism, free trade, and so on. But now, actually, trade is becoming much more subservient to reaching the strategic goals.
Mm. I have a question in that regard, to try to understand how the EU is positioning itself in that realm. Looking back at the previous events of the past few weeks, with the Chinese president going for a visit to Russia and also overseeing an agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, is the EU then looking at those developments and the US maybe is being singled out, so maybe it's time to drop our Western ally and taking another road so the EU has a better chance for the future and economically and also defense-wise, military-wise?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point in the sense that the European Union is actually walking a very tight line, because on the one hand, the US remains our most important ally. And I think the war in Ukraine shows very well how much we still depend on the Americans for our security and defense. So had it not been from the US, I think the situation in Ukraine would have been totally different. So we should, and also the Europeans realize this, and actually also the war in Ukraine has brought the EU and NATO actually closer together, and there is a lot of interaction. So, and also in its strategic documents, the European Union all the time emphasizes that the Americans remain our most important ally. And so also actually talk about further strengthening the bonds. At the same time, we see that this does not mean that the EU and the US agree on everything. And we see that when it comes to China, the Americans take a much more aggressive approach. And Europe, of course, the European Union very much also depends on China for imports of goods. On the one hand, we export a lot to China, but we also import a lot of from China. And so, for example, when it comes to solar panels, for example, well, we also now want to start develop more and more our own panels. But actually, for the time being, if we want to be successful with our energy transition, we really need these Chinese imports. Mm-hmm. And so the European Union is much more careful and in the relationship with China, and actually would like to take a kind of middle position. Mm. On the one hand, of course, we are allies of the US and we want to closely cooperate with them because we have a lot of common interests and values. At the same time, even though we may not necessarily share the values of the Chinese, there are also common interests. Mm. And also when it comes, for example, to climate change, the European Union realizes that now, if we want to address climate change, the dialogue with China will continue to be important and will be crucial, actually. So in that sense, the European Union takes a different position than the US. But of course, it is being pressured by the Americans to be more assertive towards China. And we have seen that very much also in the Netherlands, you know, with ASML, this important factory who produces machines for chips. Well, during his visit to Washington, D.C., when meeting Biden, Mark Rutte was very much put under pressure to limit the export of certain machines to China. And we don't know what really was said there, but yeah, the expectation is indeed, or we have seen also that there have been some limits on the exports of these machines. So you see that it's really a very delicate game, whereby the European Union on the one hand wants to, of course, continue to have strong relations with the US, but with regard to China, it's in its interest to continue to have close relations as well.
Mm. And is there a certain consensus among the member states towards that policy? Like, as you mentioned, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, some member states agreed that they still need the US military support, but maybe some member states were like, this is why we need to be autonomous, and that's why we need to break away from the US support. What is the debate among the member states when it comes to open strategic autonomy?
Yeah, again, a very interesting question. Indeed, the member states do not necessarily agree. I think most agree that indeed, for the time being, we still very much need the Americans for our security. But also with Trump, for example, we have seen that, well, it can also be quite a risky strategy to rely only on the Americans. So the pressure for the Europeans to do more in the field of security and defense is very high. But countries like Poland, but also the Baltic states, so Central and Eastern European countries, are very much, well, arguing that an independent European security role is not feasible. And they are afraid that if the EU becomes too active in the field of security and defense, the Americans may lose interest or may turn away. And this is absolutely not what they want. At the same time, we see that as a result of the war in Ukraine, also the North Atlantic Alliance has been profiting from this, has been strengthened, and most recently has even enlarged with Finland, and hopefully in the future also with Sweden. So in that sense, I think NATO continues to be very important, and I think nobody in the EU denies that it continues to be an important player. But what I think is also positive is that there is a realization that the Europeans have to invest more in their own security and defense. develop more their own capabilities. So for years, the Americans were also asking actually for the Europeans to invest more in their security. But yeah, the defense budgets were not there. But that has definitely changed since the war. And I expect that this is going to continue. And very positive is that you see that this close cooperation also between NATO and the EU.
To stay with the idea of how some member states might fall more in the Europeanist camp, which I guess much more favors a more aggressive approach towards strategic autonomy. And then there's the more Atlanticist side, there's some that kind of don't view it as a productive path to go down or to pursue, especially if it would weaken NATO or the transatlantic alliance. Are there also other fault lines, for example, neutral member states like Austria or Ireland? I know they're not big players, but they are still part of the European Union. How would you then put all those together in the idea of the pursuit of strategic autonomy in different levels, shall we say?
Yeah, it is indeed a challenge. And there are indeed these different groups of countries, as you say. And this is why actually the strategy of the European Union has been more to work on the level of operational autonomy and industrial autonomy. Because on the strategic level, it's more difficult to come to an agreement. So what we see is that in the last decade, we have seen some developments like, for example, permanent structured cooperation, whereby actually those who are willing can cooperate on particular projects. And so this means that you then do not necessarily have to have everybody on board. And we have also seen that the European budget, the EU budget through the European Defence Fund, is also supporting the development of common weapons like patrol corvette ship is a small warship, or for example drones or all type of different capabilities. And so not all the member states have to cooperate or to participate in that. And so that is one way actually to also address this diversity, so that those who want, they can move ahead in particular concrete projects. And perhaps it's also interesting to mention here that, and because we talk a lot about the European Union, but of course security and defense is in the first place a competence of the member states. And we see also that on bilateral level, there is a lot going on. For example, in the Netherlands, there is a very close cooperation now with Germany in the fields of security, and a very close cooperation in the field of artillery and also tanks. And so in that sense, so what we see is not that there are all kind of initiatives, but there are not necessarily the EU27, but groups of member states. For example, not everybody needs a warship, but so countries for whom this is very important work on a common warship. And so another initiative which is quite interesting is, for example, military mobility. If you want to move troops, you also have to make sure that the train tracks are compatible on all kind of other dimensions. There are also administrative dimensions to this. Well, so the European Union is now also working on that. And interestingly enough, also with the Americans. So PESCO is meant for the member states. But if the US is interested or Canada, they can also participate in projects. And so this is now also what is happening there. And so we see a lot of let's say, many initiatives, which are not necessarily always all the member states. And we see also that sometimes the European Commission, for example, through this European Defence Fund, can play a role. So that's also quite interesting, because the Commission traditionally had no role at all in security and defence. So but through this Defence Fund, they can give an impulse to the cooperation.
It seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I understood correctly, it seems like the strategy is the EU's way to become its own player while maintaining the flexibility to take on the initiatives that would serve its own interests. Is that how we can view it?
Yeah, indeed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do have a follow-up question on Macron's visit, though. One of the main conversations in that visit was that the US and China are fighting over Taiwan. China keeps on threatening that it will invade Taiwan and at any time. And the US said that it's willing to protect Taiwan and militarize Taiwan to defend itself. And here Macron is taking a stance to say that we don't want to be followers anymore, meaning that they don't want to follow the US in its wars. But they also have a different strategy in addressing China's threat for violence. For example, the Commission of von der Leyen said that China should stop threatening with violence because that's not acceptable. But at the same time, Macron said that we shouldn't be the people, or we shouldn't be the institute that should have a say in what China does and does not. So I'm kind of wondering how is it working on a commission level, but also member states level, when it comes to talking about strategic autonomy and taking decisions within the international relations realm?
Yeah, so indeed, I think you are pointing to the fact that, of course, in the European Union, there are many players. So on the one hand, you have the member states, especially the big member states like France and Germany. On the other hand, you also have the European Commission. You have also the European Council with a very active president, Charles Michel. He's also very active when it comes to EU external relations. You have also the Parliament. However, I think when it comes to really strategic issues, the key player is the European Council. And in the European Council, well, you have, of course, the chair is Charles Michel, but also President von der Leyen is present. And you have the heads of state or government who are there. And I think that is actually the main forum where the strategic issues are being discussed and debated. And of course, it's sometimes difficult to come to an agreement because there are different views. But we have also seen in the case of the war in Ukraine, when really there is a lot of at stake, the member states in the end come to an agreement because they know if they don't, they will have no impact at all. And so I think that because of these geopolitical developments now, this has really had a unifying effect on the European Union. So we are living in periods of crisis. And so we have been going from one crisis to the other. And I think also in the pandemic, we have seen this, although, of course, initially member states were looking for their own national solutions, they also realized we are much more stronger if we buy the vaccines together, if we coordinate, people are also asking for free movement and so on. So in that sense, I think it's also interesting to see actually that the European Council has been a key player in the last decade, because we have been facing much more crisis situations. And then, of course, when there is a crisis, this is what we call Chefsache. It's a matter for the heads of state and government. You don't leave this to your ministers of foreign affairs, for example.
I think this might be a good moment to maybe ask how you view this developing maybe in the next few years. It's obviously difficult the further we go out to speculate almost, but it's always interesting to hear what you have to think.
Indeed, I don't have the crystal ball, but it's a fascinating debate at the moment. And I think it's also clear from this podcast that the debate is still ongoing. And I think it's good to make a distinction between the debate on the security level and the trade level. In the field of security, we have seen also that the development of strategic autonomy is a very sensitive matter, especially for countries of Central and Eastern Europe. And we have also seen with the war in Ukraine, of course, that strategic autonomy for the EU is still very much an illusion. So in that sense, I think the cooperation with the US will remain very important. At the same time, I think the war in Ukraine, but also before Trump, have shown that it's important that the European Union is doing more. We see already that member states are starting to invest more in their security, and we see that there is also an increase of European projects of developing joint capabilities. But it's still very limited. And we spend a lot of money actually on security, but because it's so fragmented actually, we are not very efficient. So there is still a long way to go, and there is also quite some diversity in the views of the member states. In the field of economic autonomy, and this whole idea of open strategic autonomy, this concept has been, well, it was also contested in the beginning because France, for example, didn't like the addition open, whereas other countries like the Netherlands and Sweden and many others were rather critical about strategic autonomy in the field of security, of trade, because they thought it would be a form of protectionism. So, but we see that over the years, and because this debate is ongoing for more than 6-7 years now, we see that actually positions are to some extent converging, because we also see that the world has become more rough. And I think there also the war in Ukraine has given another push to this debate of open strategic autonomy, whereby the European Union realizes, well, on the one hand, it's important that we are protecting the multilateral rules and or advocating multilateralism. And we don't want to go the protectionist road because everybody is losing. But at the same time, the European Union also sees that, for example, China is quite aggressive when it comes to public procurement, when it comes to its Belt and Road Initiative. And so in that sense, we have seen that although some of the countries were quite critical of strategic autonomy in the field of external relations, there has been more openness towards this, because they want to make sure that we also have the raw materials to still make the products we need to make.
Thank you for the information and for clearing up the concept for us. And we can obviously talk about this for hours and hours, and it would never be enough. So maybe for our listeners, it would be nice if you can recommend some sources for them to dig deeper into this subject if they want to.
Yes, I think that's an interesting question as well. I would encourage the listeners perhaps to have a look at the speech of Macron at the Sorbonne back in September 2017, when he talked about this idea of, European sovereignty. He does not use the term autonomy so much. He prefers the term sovereignty. But I think that is a very interesting moment, because it has been giving an important boost to the debate. And it's also important because it's extending the term also to non-security issues. Another, I think, very interesting document, perhaps a bit more boring to read, but nevertheless, for those who would like to know more, is this trade policy review of the European Commission in 2021. When it launched this term of open strategic autonomy. And so that was also a very important moment, because you see how the European Union is actually struggling with this need to become more protectionist of its own interests on the one hand, and defending or continuing to defend its traditional principles of free trade and multilateralism. And if I may, I'm working on this topic myself together with a colleague from the University of Bristol, Professor Anna Junkos. We have prepared an article on strategic autonomy, and we compare the areas of security and trade. But for the moment, the article is not out yet, but hopefully it will be there in the next year.
All the luck then with with the article and all the sources that you...
Sorry. Don't worry. I just have one shameless plug. Also, if you're interested, we already had an episode on digital sovereignty, which could also be interesting to listen to if this conversation then interested you.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sherelle.
No. Also, when you mentioned that we are going from crisis to crisis, also brought to mind that we also had an episode called Forged in Crisis, our last episode. So also it would be interesting. It would be like a nice build up to this episode if you want to dig deeper into the EU strategy to being autonomous. So yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for being with us in this episode and for sharing this information with us. All the sources that you mentioned and we mentioned will be also linked into this in the description of this episode. So thank you, Dr. Sophie von Hohenecker, for being with us. It was really a pleasure having this conversation with you.
Many thanks. It has been a pleasure for me too.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Stay tuned, everyone, for the next episode. The music for the MD podcast episode has been produced by Stone Ocean. And this podcast episode has been produced, recorded, and edited by Brendan Hogan and yours truly, Sherelle Abdullah. Talk to you soon.